Yes, no, I'll ask one.
So the question is whether the 80 metres is an appropriate distance for the, mm. for the roads. So for the airport noise, if I draw the parallel first because it might help understand that, they map out where a 55 dB contour is, and they say, well, if you're inside that contour, then you probably need to shut your windows to get a reading when the inside so you've got to insulate. For the roads, it generally isn't practical to map out a contour for the entire road network because there's an awful lot more of it. Involves a disproportionate amount of work, so they approximate it to a distance. And the 80 metres generally incorporates an area where you'd have to shut your windows to get a reasonable amount of insight. The reality of it is that if you were to do a contour, it would generally be bigger than 80 metres. So the 80 metres isn't addressing everywhere where there could be sleep disturbance if you don't treat houses, but it's addressing most places. There will be some locations inside the 80 metres where you don't need insulation. So, for example, if the terrain shields the road, or if you're the second row of houses back and there's a fairly dense row of houses in front of you, then you wouldn't need to treat your house. So for those people, they'd be caught up in the rule, and they'd have to go through an assessment process and say, hey, actually, the sound levels at this house are lower, so you don't need to treat it. There's provision for that. But as an extent where generally it represents where acoustic treatment is needed, yes, I think the 80 metres is appropriate, or if anything, I think the 80 metres is probably slightly too short a distance. It could ideally extend it a little further.
Thank you.
Just on that, Dr. Charles, the NZTA submission sought that the 80 metres from the seal edge rather than the road boundary, and also only in the circumstances where the speed limit was 70 kilometres an hour or greater, where it was less than 70 kilometres an hour, that's 40 metre as the area. Would you, I see that you've suggested lower limits in several places here, one of which is the at 50 kilometre hour zone, which is the Anderson Road to Ardmore Street section. And Frankton Road, doesn't part of that fall into the less than 70 kilometre an hour zone?
So in terms of what ends up in the plan, that will obviously be bound by the scope of the submissions that the agency have made. In terms of the noise effects, Frankton Road has got a significantly higher traffic volume, and the sound levels remain elevated at a greater distance from the road. So I mean, if you take on my summary statement where you've got those three areas, on the Station Highway 6, as you go past towards Macarora, the traffic volumes become very much lower. So the reduction in distance there isn't because of the speed, because it's all still 100 kilometres an hour, it's because there's less traffic. Whereas Frankton Road is the opposite, where there is a reduction in speed, but there's still significant traffic volumes. But the distance you end up with is obviously about by the scope.
The other question on Frankton Road I had is that the recommendation as for a high density zone for the strip between the lake and Frankton Road, for a large part anyway, is that the top of the buildings not be higher than the elevation of the midpoint of the road. Would that have an effect on the noise effects on those buildings once they're built?
Yes. Going back some years, I was involved in a couple of the developments there where you've got apartments that sort of step down from the road, and you tend to, for those developments that I looked at previously, the top apartment was fairly much level with the road, and they had to sort of for me, it was particularly thick glazing on the facades that were more affected by road traffic. Because as you step down towards the lake, then you need progressively less or potentially no sound insulation as you come down. It's a type of thing that you just got to look at on a site-specific basis because the topography is so key. But you are right, that because if I hadn't picked up on that rule, but if the top of the building is limited to the road height, that will reduce any sound insulation requirements.
Well, thank you, Dr. Thanks
very much.
Thank you, Chair. Next witness is Mr. Osborne.
Queenstown Lake District housing market has seen significant and rapid changes over the past 15 years. These changes have resulted in substantial shifts in the affordability of homes in the district, as well as important impacts on community wellbeing and the cost of living in the community. Outside of Auckland, the district has the highest nominal average house price in the country, with a growth rate exceeding any other area in New Zealand. While the residential housing growth rates in Auckland have subdued over the past 12 months, the district has not experienced the same tempering of growth. With an average price of over $950,000, the level of affordability has resulted in home ownership levels across all households of only 35%, and only 8% for those under 40 years old. Since 2006, the district has experienced the largest fall in home ownership rates across the country, with an average mortgage accounting for over 50% of average upbringing's income. A key component of the property market in the district is the number of vacant site transactions. These are not only high in terms of quantum, but also in terms of the number of transactions. This would indicate a significant market in land speculation. A further unique factor in relation to the district's residential property market is the level of private visitor residents that absorb considerable levels of residential demand for temporary non-residents. This section of the market accounts for nearly 20% of growth in the market to 2045. It is estimated that over the past 15 years, residential housing demand rose by nearly 7,000 homes, while the corresponding supply fell short by over 1,000 homes. This latent demand is currently playing its role in the ongoing pressure on house prices and affordability. It is estimated that by 2045, the district will require between 10,000 and 16,000 new residential dwellings to meet new demand. As indicated by the changing home ownership and affordability rates, an increasing proportion of this demand will be required in the lower price and income brackets. It is fundamental in terms of economic well-being that the proposed district plan consider the changing residential environment in the district. The district has the opportunity to address the issues of affordability and build supply through the increased provision for medium high-density residential development in centralised locations. The intensification of residential activity is often accompanied by both economic costs and benefits. It is important to have consideration for these in the district context. The potential economic costs of this intensification include increased construction costs, increased congestion, property value changes, increased land prices, market acceptance and viability, and financing. However, the district market has several mitigating factors in relation to these costs, including a lack of supply in the lower price ranges, a significant level of properties exhibiting low improvement to capital ratios, a and significant growth potential. These factors are likely to reduce the risks associated with medium and high density developments. Economic risks. The economic benefits of residential intensification include improved infrastructure efficiencies, reduced transportation costs, agglomeration and associated activity benefits, lower social infrastructure costs, providing more diverse choice of housing options, greater affordability, improved land efficiency, and greater levels of ownership. Rather than simply adding to the land available for redevelopment, medium and high density residential options offer significant economic benefits to the, in the district context. Many of the potential costs are already mitigated by the market, while appropriate provisions can be applied to minimising the remaining costs. From an economic perspective, the encouraging and facilitation of medium and high density residential development in the district will improve community well-being and the economic viability of the district.
I've got quite a few. Thanks, Mr. Oswald. One of the characteristics of the proposed planning approach, and you've touched on it, is the spatial characteristics of opportunities for medium and high density housing. Are you comfortable that the locations identified in the plan for medium and high density housing are the places where the people that you think might benefit from them want to live?
I'm comfortable that those locations offer those people the amenity and accessibility that they require from an economic sense.
That's a very good answer.
Yeah.
I think the question was driven by a desire to be sure that we don't get caught in the trap of thinking that we're going to solve a theoretical problem with theoretical capacity and theoretical solutions that might not ever be taken up if they're not what the people we're talking about actually want. And I'm sure you've seen that in other districts.
I would perhaps add to that question a moment, because essentially I was going to ask something similar, but probably less subtle. The high density zones in particular, the location of them, specifically in the areas which are going to have the highest premium on any residential development, is that the best way to provide high density development that will provide for that low end of the market that you talked about? And I'm meaning, essentially, we're talking Lakeview, Suburban Monica, or Queenstown, unobstructed Lakeviews, and things like that.
I think there are potentially two questions within that. One deals with the preference of the market, whether it's willing to accept these types of dwelling types. And that falls on both sides of the market. That is whether the market is willing to actually develop these product types as well. And that to a degree is driven by demand, but it's also driven by the viability of these options. And that's something that the council is currently working on and looking at the likely viability of these in a much more fine-grained sense in terms of whether the market will in fact produce these options. In terms of the preferences, preferences are quite dynamic, especially in a market as constrained as Queenstown. And by constrained, I simply mean constrained in terms of home ownership options. And there's the potential to meet not only some of that low-end demand through the provision of this medium to high-density option, but also to take some of the additional heat out of the market that's provided by more expensive options. I think that the question that was put was that you've got some locations where high density is going to be, is not necessarily going to be catering for those low income and low house price brackets. So I think one thing that Queenstown is lacking at the moment is simply a quantum of built options. And that filters through the entire market. That is that if you provide for the higher end product, then you dissipate some of the demand for it moving further down. That is that you are actually providing built products to the market. And that's one of the key things that is relatively unique, and not just the Queenstown. I mean, Auckland is having the problem of not having enough built form. But in Queenstown, you've got a very active land market, but it is falling short in terms of that built form. And I think anything that increases that and increases the viability of actually having some of these sites taken up and built on is going to help the overall affordability of the market, even if it doesn't target the affordability end of the spectrum itself.
Yeah, now, you will recall that you provided evidence in the rural stream.
Yes, correct.
Mr. Goldsmith, acting for several submitters, used exactly the same argument that you've just produced as to why there should be more subdivision in the rural areas, because that will create high value sections which will take some of the heat out of the market.
Yes.
So the hearing panel should consider that in the same light, should it?
I think that was dealing with it. I mean, there are, from an economic point of view and from a theoretical point of view, you would build as much capacity as you could. But there are counterbalances to that. And some of those counterbalances are economic, and in the rural sense, they had an effect on an outstanding landscape, or potential effect on an outstanding landscape and outstanding features that had potentially a much greater economic risk associated with them than the benefits that increased housing would provide. And I think you still have those counterbalances in the medium and high density zones. That is that you wouldn't build beyond a certain height just simply to provide additional units to the market, simply because you affect the amenity of either neighbours, or you change the, you build a 30-storey apartment block in the middle of Queenstown, you change the nature of Queenstown itself, which means that ultimately you are going to have flow-on economic costs. And I think that, therefore, there are counterbalances, there are restrictions on how much density you can put in some of these areas. But those are potentially driven, in this case, by other factors other than economic. Their amenity or their visual, their urban design issues, more than they are economic, even though they ultimately have economic impacts. So I would say that in terms of the rural, there were risks associated with that that were greater than the simple addition of more housing in those areas would suggest.
Thanks, sir. I've heard it said elsewhere that at a certain point, section size and the cost of land, even at lower values, is such a proportion of the cost that low density, large section product doesn't help achieve affordability. Notwithstanding your general argument about if there's more butter in the bucket, there's more to go around. And at the other end, I've heard it said that apartments cost so much to construct relative to other materials that the highest density, whether it's 3 stories or 50 stories, just gives people a heck of a lot less for their buck and maybe isn't the right way to try and promote affordable solutions. But that somewhere in the middle there's a sweet spot of 2 to 3 level timber-based construction on small sites that bang for your buck is the thing to target for. Do you have any thoughts, as we're grappling with low and high and medium densities and affordability, where the greatest return is likely?
Unfortunately, that's not a static point. It's quite dynamic,
yeah,
in that, especially as your land values increase, that point and that trade-off between the size and the appropriateness of your dwelling is traded off against the price of the land. And the market typically will find that if it is provided enough option to meet it. In the context of Auckland, it was quite a rigorous process for the ACDC model that was produced, and it found that of the 200,000 THAB, the high density zone that was provided for, only 7% of that was actually viable in the market. But as time went on, more an increasing proportion of that obviously becomes viable. And I think that the market does find that sweet spot, as long as it's given sufficient locational and sufficient quantum of options.
Okay, so in summary, we shouldn't try and focus affordability disproportionately on any one particular type of zone or density. We should be saying across all the residential zones, everything should be done to make whatever it is as affordable as possible. Is that a fair?
From an economic and a social point of view, yes.
Yeah, okay.
I would say that that's true.
Okay. I didn't pick up in your evidence or your summary, and forgive me if it's there, any particular advice on the reasonably high rate of second home / holiday home ownership in this district, and whether that means we should be building twice as many houses as we might otherwise need, because so many of them just get left vacant by rich doctors, lawyers, accountants, pilots from elsewhere, etc. Do you have any comments on that?
That was essentially what I was alluding to in terms of the 20% of the market, where I talked about Queenstown being quite a unique market in terms of 20% of the growth expected to 2025 being in that category that you just talked about. And it makes for a headache, probably more for infrastructure than it does in terms of economics. But it is a demand that is absorbing that capacity, and it's absorbing it without necessarily the economic returns that come from permanent residents as well. So it's a difficult situation for Queenstown to know whether to continue to provide enough to actually satisfy that part of the market, or whether that part of the market will be reduced by simply the prices that are currently delivered here. To a large part, it actually plays quite a role in the transaction of sites as well, because it provides a profile for Queenstown, where people come in and they buy houses that they don't necessarily use, but they see it as an economic option because the prices are rising so quickly. And if it becomes managed in a better way in terms of those price rises, you may see that option falling away for some people. So you may see a decrease in that demand.
Sure.
Okay. Second houses here.
That's helpful, thanks. But how I'd perceive the issue you've described was that in terms of a resource management response, accepting there's a whole range of other responses that central and local government might in time put in place. If we're talking about trying to increase the supply of product for all the reasons you've described, and the order of 20% of that product is probably not actually helping contribute to that answer because it's being purchased for different reasons, etc. Does that actually mean the focus should be on providing even more supply, accepting that we're not necessarily, you know, we have a capacity of zone, but take out 20%. Do we actually still have enough left over to achieve all those benefits you talked about before of more supply, affordability benefits, etc., etc.? Are you still comfortable if only 80% of what the plan's talking about contributes to that? That is enough.
I am comfortable that is enough. In terms of what we're expecting and what we've assessed in terms of the demand and supply balance, we have considered those additional houses in that assessment. So we have considered those anyway, but I'm happy that the focus should be on that other 80%, essentially.
In terms of the medium and high density zones, and if you don't have an answer, that's fine as a forewarning to start with. But if you have reviewed the position of the council on what the heights, densities, other rules are, and accepting in those medium and high density zones, most of them already have buildings of varying degrees of density already on them. Are you satisfied that the carrot, if you like, of redevelopment benefit is sufficient, that it's actually going to be redeveloped or not?
We've got some way to look at the viability under the DCM model and include that viability in there. To look at the, as I've talked about, in terms of balance, the improvement, the capital ratio, whether people will be moving houses or knocking them down and increasing their density. It's a difficult question to answer because I'm looking at this purely from an economic point of view. From an economic point of view, I would probably go further in terms of those densities, but I understand that there are
capabilities. Well, let those other people speak for themselves. Yeah. I'm interested in what you would
do. So, I mean, there are areas potentially where I would go a little bit further in terms of that density.
Could you give us a bit more light on what they might be and what you might do?
I mean, I'm thinking about the size of the sites, probably. Okay. Than anything else, and the difference between the 450 and the 350 and things like that, some of the potential bonuses that are given to some areas, and the purely economic rationale behind that would suggest that if you can go down to 350, that should be something that you should attempt to do across the link.
Really?
Those notes.
Okay. I mean, it's for us to make a view on the submissions. What sustainable management means, and sometimes it means everyone compromises. But sometimes it means issue X is so much more important than other issues that issue X has to be the winner. And that's not necessarily a position that has been put before us across the board on the basis of everyone saying there are these other compromises here, there and the other. And that's not to say it's wrong, but where it gets to is that there is a scenario in light of the documented housing problems in the district that we could find ourselves in agreement with those submissions promoting that the economics-based perspective should be given more weighting in the mix. Mm. And if we did, what's the most appropriate, direct, easiest way to try and get your thoughts on what those opportunities might be over and above the answers you're helpfully trying to give us now? I'm not sure what that is, Mr. Chair, and I don't know how that will be done, but it seems to me if there's a council witness suggesting that from his own perspective he'd go further, I'm trying to think what the most helpful way of getting that might be.
Well, I think the way you have phrased the question, I think, is totally within Mr. Osborne's competence to tell us. He doesn't have to agree with what the council's position is. If it's his view that a certain site size from an economic point of view is the most desirable, I think it's useful for us to know what those are so that we balance, have that information to balance against all the other factors which the planners, etc., will put for us. So I think you can be as explicit as possible is probably the best way to put it, Mr. Osborne.
Could we get it in writing too?
It's probably better at this stage to provide it just in writing to you, my position on that.
Look, I find it very helpful, and I certainly don't think you need to add the disclaimer that it's just an economics perspective. We understand all that. So anyway, back to the mainstream questions. One of the interesting things I saw coming out of the Auckland process was the panel's response to its own analysis of what it felt wasn't enough zoning. And one of the things they did was provide as a permitted option in some zones the family flat, the residential flat idea that in this plan is proposed to be on the table. But it struck me as interesting to see how a unit that can be lived in by an independent household but can't be subdivided or sold or disposed of was seen as a legitimate part of that housing solution. So where I'm going here is, what role do you see the family flat option having in Queenstown, given that it can't actually be sold off? And is there a segment of the market that just wants a roof over their head and don't care if they can't own it, or is it actually about home ownership?
There is a segment that simply want a roof over their head, and I mean that is an issue in Queenstown, and probably even more of an issue than it is currently in Auckland. The actual proportional issue is probably higher here in Queenstown. There are issues around not being able to subdivide that in terms of ownership and in terms of just financing and all the other things that go along with that. But it is a short to medium term solution, especially for Queenstown, in terms of providing those additional roofs that are required to take some of the heat out of the market, as it were.
My last question, and it's going back to where I started, and the follow-on questions from the chair about things like development in the rural zone. So one of the things that's happened through that housing accords law that the central government passed, and some of the accord authorities, they've defined housing affordability in terms of the price you pay. Not necessarily things like the incremental savings of spending less time and money and energy on transport through the air, the incremental efficiencies of infrastructure, a lot of those benefits you talked about that I understand. There's an argument that in that respect it's really just about price, and it's a drag race. And one of the obvious consequences of that, as you'll know in Auckland, is to push really high density product out to the extreme edge of town, because when price is the only issue, that's what you do. In the Queenstown context, and notwithstanding your comments about supporting the medium and high density zones and your comments about perhaps should go further generally, do you think if we were to be attracted by the social and economic issues of housing affordability, we would look at higher density in, let's just forget what zone it might be, but let's just say the edge of the settlement, the edge of those urban development boundaries? Do you think that's something that we would logically lead to, or do you think that's something that's not economically necessary or appropriate?
It's a very interesting question, and it's one I think that Auckland should have asked itself before it decided to go to where it did. I mean, essentially the difference is the housing affordability versus the cost of living. And as you've rightly pointed out, we can continue to make affordable housing in much more remote locations and reduce accessibility and reduce amenity and reduce all those other things that contribute to the cost of living and to the well-being of the community. I think it is very important to consider that cost of living when you're locating that that medium to high density product. I think it's something that hasn't been considered either in the spatial dimensions of the SAB zone or the special housing areas that have been provided. I think what we're doing essentially is we're lowering the cost of the house and we're increasing the cost of everything else that's associated with it. And we're doing that in a disproportionate way in terms of the socio-demographic profile of those people. So I think it is very important to consider when locating that product, as I think too, and I would agree with the spatial extent of what Queenstown had proposed, that that's considered in those options.
Just in answering that, were you taking into account the difference that this district has compared to Auckland, where at present one of the options for people is to live somewhere like Cromwell, where it is noticeably cheaper, or Kingston, or Glenorchy, and already those distance factors are an issue. Would that make a difference if you could get those people, instead of travelling 40 minutes to Queenstown each way, they could be closer?
Absolutely. I think in terms of that, I think the exact example is people living in Hamilton, Garrett, and travelling to Auckland, and that's what we're finding more and more of in terms of that affordable housing, but the real impact that it has on people's lives and the cost of living those lives over and above simple refurbishment. So I think that is something that needs to be considered in terms of conglomeration or agglomeration of the people where they actually want to live and where they work. Looking at those options.
Okay.
Okay. Last question. You will have heard the discussion that the panel had Dr. Charles just before you. And I asked questions about proximity to the airport and density restrictions. Putting aside, no, let's just follow on directly from that. So putting aside the acoustic issue, which can be dealt with through unit internal design, and let's say for the sake of argument that one can get over the operational nuisance of people making complaints to an airport operator, pretty flat land, close to a lot of things, would economically speaking, you be suggesting that the absolute best use of that land could be made, or would you be suggesting that in light of people not liking noise, that sort of thing generally, that that would be a driver to not promote more development there?
I would be suggesting in terms of the airport's contribution to the economy that the level of risk associated with impacting that is significant enough not to good. Put that at risk.
All right, good. Thank you for all of those answers. Thanks, sir.
I'm scared of going to ask something he's already asked. But air players have been working hard over the last number of years, more so recently, have tried and find ways to make housing more affordable by looking at things like densities and rules and so on. And you know, quite a bit has been achieved, and Gordon particular is quite hopeful. Council is a pestering them on gaps and people ground up there. Is there anything we've missed in where we are with the proposed district plan with regard to more affordable housing in this area?
I don't think so. In terms of notwithstanding what I talked about, I guess, in terms of some of the potential site sizes that could be achieved economically and viably, I think the way that the district plan is actually set up is quite comprehensive at this point and will ultimately have an impact on the market.
Got a couple of clarifications in your evidence. In paragraph 4.6, the third sentence of that paragraph, can you just tell me what that means?
So the first part of that, this is the paragraph study, you've got the cost and benefits?
Yeah, economic cost and benefits, simply for the two categories, yes.
The first part of that is simply talking about the impacts that fall under, that aren't considered by the market. The second part of that, which starts, the second relates to efficiencies and infrastructure and public service provision, is simply talking about having an aggregation of activity, an intensification of activity in a particular location where there is either capacity in the existing infrastructure or infrastructure can be used effectively and efficiently. That is the marginal cost of that infrastructure.
I understood the second though. It was that particular sentence. Is that third sentence that says the market will not consider itself in deciding the price and level, does that really mean it would not consider the first, the externalities?
Yes. Right. Yes, that's essentially what the externalities are true. Sorry. Yes.
And then paragraph 6.3, you've referred there, residents in a compact higher density urban form transferred 20%. 20% of what?
Sorry, 20% in terms of the 20%, 20% less standard.
Right. Now, the other question we've got, I'm more cracking. One of those difficult tasks that Parliament has given to us is to consider the costs and benefits of policies and rules. Have you done any quantitative work on the costs and benefits of the rules in the residential zones in terms of site size, setbacks, height limits, that sort of thing?
Not for this.
How would we consider, for instance, a setback control which requires the house be built 2 metres from the boundary? How would we consider the costs and benefits of that versus none?
From an economic point of view, I mean, probably the best example to use is the height restrictions, for example, which was one that was hotly contested in Auckland. And in terms of the economic costs and benefits of that, a counterfactual position was established that said you could go in most places, metropolitan centre, to 70 metres. In some places, there was an overlay that restricted that by 36 to 36 metres. And that was inherent in the underlying zoning, unfortunately. And in terms of assessing the economic impacts of that, what was looked at was the loss of development potential. So in terms of a setback, it would be difficult to assess unless it actually had an impact on the development potential of particular sites. And if those sites couldn't be developed viably anymore because of that increased setback, it would be difficult to assess any specific and quantifiable economic cost and benefits of that, as opposed to simply having to use some land for something that's not a roof.
Can I ask the first follow-up? From your topic, from your answer regarding the height, how they dealt with it, if we were to look at Auckland location rules, would it be useful for us to have the ability to look at other districts and how they deal with the rules and then measure the effects here against the effects there? That seemed to be what you were saying there, didn't it?
You could use that as a counterfactual position, if it was justifiable. That would be your counterfactual position, where you could go to either a higher extent where it was supported by other expert areas, such as the area of design rules and so forth, and supported there, what those likely impacts are of having a lower height.
So just on that topic of quantifying costs and benefits, and I understand that height example of looking at lost opportunity. Would you, or are you aware of, either or, any examples where a council looked through its own history of consents from the point of view of the time and cost and stress and uncertainty of having to go through a resource consent process? And what I mean there is, for whatever reason, when you were discussing it with the chair, I was reminded, it popped into my head, of a study the MFE did in the 90s. It looked at a whole bunch of front yard contraventions across the country, and it found that all of the consents had been granted, and it was questioning whether it was a complete waste of time. I'm paraphrasing, of course. The words they used were more diplomatic. They said, are they being rubber stamped? But would that be one factor that you think would be legitimate and an economic consideration of cost benefits, that sort of thing, of rules?
Absolutely. One of the first costs we look at are essentially called transaction costs, which is exactly that. And there's quite a bit of recent research around that, especially because these transaction costs are thought to have a dampening effect on the availability of supply and just viability as well. So there's quite a bit of information around about what sort of impacts these rules and so forth have on the final product, especially.
Thanks.
Thanks for that.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you. We now turn to Mr. Faulkner.
Yes. Mr. Osborne's done a good job of warming the seat.
It's because it's the hot seat.
Yes, as well. I anticipate this is going to be another interesting discussion.
Yes, we agree, Mr. Portman.
Very good. Okay, so I'll just read my summary of evidence. Which starts off by to improve the urban form and control the extent of urban growth, the proposed district plan for the Queenstown Lakes District has adopted a compact urban form model based on establishing urban growth boundaries. This provides a context for requiring greater efficiencies throughout the different residential zones and increases the importance of good design to increase quality and outcomes. Looking at low density zone, this is the largest residential zone by area, and the PDP includes significant initiatives to improve the performance of traditional low-rise detached development. Overall, I have supported and added several recommendations largely to improve consistency. These suggestions include the requirement for stronger design control from subdividing existing lots, this term gentle density. The steepening of recession planes to allow more flexibility in providing two-storey design, and the retention of the ODP approach of defined outdoor living courts. Looking at medium density zone, which includes duplexes, terraces, and small townhouses, these will increasingly make up a significant element of residential development in this district. Design becomes more important in a denser living environment, and although this has not been sought through submissions, I believe that a specific medium density residential design guideline needs to be prepared to help applicants and shorten the processing of applications. Increased use of the existing urban design panel is also recommended to improve discussions around design. In general, to increase consistency and efficiency, I've supported a lower minimum lot area, that of 150 square metres, and increasing the maximum height to 10 metres to allow for three-level. The high-density residential zone requires sensitive design consideration, and I further recommended specific design guidelines and the use of the urban design panel. The Bothamus School modelling study that was recently provides evidence for proposed setback in session planes. Further, I believe that reference to the floor area ratio fire controls and deciding development to complex is not appropriate. I have supported refinement of some of the controls on site coverage and building. There have been a number of specific submissions, not surprisingly, relating to controls of individual properties which have required testing of consistency of rules and in some cases specific contextual considerations. And looking at large lot residential zone, this provides for a transition to the rural environment and a diversity of housing choice. To achieve greater efficiency of land use, I consider the minimum lot area in general in this category could readily decrease from existing 4,000 square metres to 2,000 square metres without losing transition and amenity. However, there are several specific areas where I note that due to landscape values and natural hazards, it is, in my view, appropriate to retain the existing lot area of 4,000 square metres. Happy to take your questions.
Yes. There are a few. Look, it would be to start with some context for you. As I've read the notified provisions in the 42A recommended changes as a before and after set, I would have to declare that I've struggled to really see a consistent difference in the outcomes likely in the low density residential zone if people consistently took maximum opportunity of the gentle density type thinking. And the medium density residential zone, if people didn't push it to the absolute limit, but went something close to it. And similarly between the medium density and the high density residential zone, and I guess another way of saying that is I didn't see each of those zones talking about clearly, easily differentiated outcomes when the rules are put together. I saw quite a lot of overlap. And so what would help me would be if you could maybe first just run through what you see as the key differentiators between the low density residential zone and the medium density residential zone, and then again between the medium density and high density zone. That would probably help me to start things off.
To emphasise that, there's obvious minimum lot and sizes and height requirements through each of those graduations, I guess, and density. You're right, though, in terms of position planes and so on, setbacks. I've made note of requirements for increased setbacks, especially with rear boundaries and find a rear building code. But it's, it's that simple.
In the low density zone, there's, in the first instance, a subdivision lot size of 450, but a land use opportunity expressed as a density control, not a site area control, of 300. But as I understand reading the rules, and if you see them differently, I'd really like to see that. As I see it, if I had a 900 square metre site in the low density zone and I could qualify for the 300 density, that gives me 3 units. There's no rule anywhere that says each of those has to have its own 300 metre site, as I see the rules. As I see it, I just have 3 units I could apply for RD consent for by way of an attached terrace along the front to keep the back of my site clear for, let's hope, a future subdivision the next time the plan is reviewed.
You may be correct. I'm not speaking from a planning expertise.
But you would have assessed the urban design effects of the outcomes the rules enable, and you would have satisfied yourself that the rules will achieve an outcome for a low density zone that would distinguish that zone from a medium density zone. Otherwise, why not just have the same zone?
Yeah, so the low density zone varies in lot sizes quite widely. I think typically what we're seeing out there in practice is the subdivision into two parcels, and often you're seeing that with builders who are building deliberately on one part of the section and effectively land banking the second parcel of that one section to sell on as a vacant lot or to do another development. That's practically what's happening. I'm not seeing any multiple subdivisions, I can see that.
You talked in your summary and in your evidence as well about one story, two story, and the appropriateness in some cases of two story in the recession planes. I was interested when I looked at the rules of the extent of circumstances when a 5.5 metre height limit would apply, such as if there's a site smaller than 900 square metres, etc. You're comfortable that those impositions are justified just in terms of urban design effects, or do you think that justification is something other than urban design?
The height level for low density.
This is where the lower 5.5 metre limit would apply.
That is, I've made special note of it in my evidence. Argued often for a small increase in height, particularly to take account of the roof profile, which I think we've referred a lot in conversation this morning, I hear, to the precedents that have been recently in Auckland. And what's happened with height limits in Auckland is developers have tried to maximise the number of stories within a height envelope, and we've seen the proliferation of flat-roofed homes, which some have good design outcome, but some suffer from poor design and poor drainage. I think in particular, and so there's those issues in the district, but there's also issues to do with both the character and the prevalence and preference for a gable roof, which is the wrong roof form. So we need some height for the roof. So I've argued for that provision. Not sure whether I've answered your questions or not, really.
Well, look, we'll take whatever the experts can give us, I suppose. On that topic, though, of the roof, a lot of the pre-circulated evidence includes a lot of assertions about good urban design and roof profile and roof shape and extra height. Every experience I've had in this district and others where there's a view on offer is that a basic development objective is to elevate as much floor area as high as possible to maximise that view, which is one driver for the flat roof outcome view. And so part of me wonders whether providing more height for roof profile, unless it's explicitly tied through restrictions on what that height can be used for, it might just simply lead to the same flat roof outcomes, just slightly higher.
As an interesting, I think though in practice we are seeing few building forms developed. We're seeing predominantly bay form. So whether that's going to be a real issue, I'm not sure. I think it could be a possibility.
Well, what it comes down to then really is, I think Land Change 50 in the town centre talked about extra height, but it was non-habitable. To make it clear it was for roof articulation and interest. You don't seem to be thinking that such a follow through would be required here.
It could, but I didn't see that issue.
I don't know if you've seen any evidence that's been lodged on this, Mr. Faulkner. Mr. Williams has provided evidence suggesting that in the high density zone, the height limit should have, he's saying 9 metres, plus 2 metres to allow for roof articulation. Is that something, is that the sort of thing that you would promote?
Yeah, so that's the sort of 11 metre maximum height. It's something that Ms. Banks has addressed in her evidence, and I think it gives three generous levels and that roof articulation dedicated to articulating the roof. I think that's a good basic result.
So even if we set the height limit lower, a 2 metre articulation would be appropriate. Is that essentially what you're saying?
Rather than 12, having overall limit of 12 metres?
Yes.
Yes.
Right.
So I'll just add on to that, because I think that the problem with height limit is one that's kind of in between height limits, which potentially could allow for the sort of and flat, essentially flat roof. So at 11 metre, that's got reduction with the provision for a 2 metre roof articulation, allows 3 levels, and it's the 2 metres.
Do you, following on from that, let's say the height limit you're recommending is in place and the topography of the site is such that a developer can just excavate 1 metre below the current ground level to still get a four-storey building to fit in, would that be appropriate in terms of not exceeding the overall height outcome you're seeking, or is it the fact that it's a three-storey outcome that you think is important rather than a four or other storey outcome?
So in terms of the sloping site provisions?
Well, let's just say even on a flat site, let's just say the site's big enough that developer's happy to have 5 or 6 steps down from the level of the footpath to a lowered internal floor level that gives them an extra height limit, because I don't think the height limit measures from where you might finish digging it. Typically starts from the existing ground level in such a way that they can achieve a four-storey outcome. Would that be a problem if the overall height outcome you're promoting was still being complied with? Or do you actually think there should be something more clear about three storeys as all you think is appropriate?
So we're talking about medium density provisions?
Either or. The option is for people to excavate slightly into the ground level to squeeze in an extra story in almost all of the zones based on where the height limits are.
My understanding is that the height level with an excavated site is the median between the midpoint between the excavation and the median.
Well, we'll have to check that.
I was just thinking, actually, just off on a tangent. Overseas now, we've actually seen people excavating and creating what they call icebergs. Multiple stories.
While we're being told all about how expensive land is in this part of the world, things we might laugh off suddenly become not viable. So anyway, in any scenario, you talked about, in specific reference to the chair's question from Mr. Williams, evidence about 12 metres versus 11, and one being 3 stories with roof and one being 4 stories with a flat roof. What I'm saying is, if someone could find a way to do 4 stories in the lower height limit that you're promoting on the basis that it's 3 stories, would that actually be a problem? So is the issue the number of stories or the total height from bottom to top?
And the roof.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think it's about consistency. This is one of the key things that we're trying to strike with the plan, is consistency. If I'm just trying to see through your question, just answering it black and white. Preceding speaker is addressing the issue of quality and efforts. If we're saying landscape terms, urban formulae, overall height should be limited against the natural ground setting of 3 levels plus room for the roof, then ability to massage the contour to give you more floor space to make it more feasible and more perhaps more rentable, maybe that's a smart outcome. I'm not sure. I haven't really seen that happen, so I'm struggling to see why we'd need to put particular provision around it. I'm not really clear on that.
So we can wrap that up by saying you're satisfied that a maximum height limit can be identified. What people do within that, you're not seeing as being particularly motivational in terms of your opinions for or against or otherwise?
Well, you it opens up a whole number of things. Like, you know, should we be defining the height of a story? You know, should we be defining the width of a floor plate or something? So, you know, I'm not sure how beneficial that line of inquiry is. You know, I think clearly that they've stipulated a height level relative to ground level. And, you know, that therefore defines a height, a relative height.
Yeah.
I think that identifies that's the major issue. It's the major point to be addressed. I think the intention is clearly in that situation to provide three levels plus a roof.
Well, we're sort of going around in circles. And as much as you've just said three stories plus roof, and I'm trying to ask you how important it is that we say three stories plus roof as opposed to just saying height of X. And your answers keep telling me that it's actually not about stories, it's about whatever that height limit is, but then you keep concluding with reference to stories. And so I'm trying to figure out from you, being the design expert, whether the plan should have just meters and stories, just stories, or anything else. Because as I read the policy framework for the residential zones, there's a lot of stuff about character and what's there now, and predominantly two stories this and whatever. But if that's the issue, do the rules actually implement that or not? So I've got a bundle of those considerations in my mind, and I appreciate you trying your best to help me with questions that maybe aren't that clear, but I'm still left, on reflection of 15 minutes of conversation, still not sure whether you think we should be saying in the plan it's three stories plus roof. And if so, what does that mean?
Can you tell me your words, Mr. Faulkner?
Yes.
I'm going to be doing for lunch in a few minutes.
Yeah.
And I'll give you the chance to keep your thoughts and think about this coherently, because I was going to add into that. From an urban design point of view, it would be very useful for us to know your opinion of what would be the appropriate height limit in the various zones in the district. So from an urban design point of view, I'd like you to tell us after lunch, and I think we'll go some way to answering Commissioner Munro's question, what heights would be appropriate irrespective of what the rules say at the moment. So,
yes,
and at that point, I'll adjourn until 2 p.m.